I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Maria O'Brien, Outreach Coordinator for the Help of Southern Nevada Weatherization Program. Help of Southern Nevada is committed to assisting individuals, families, and youth throughout the Las Vegas Valley break down barriers and attain self-sufficiency through direct services, training, and referrals to community services. Maria, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So what exactly does Help of Southern Nevada do on a daily basis?
So basically, we help families reach their goals so that way they can be better efficient and self-sufficient. We have things such as family housing services, workforce services, Shannon West Homeless Youth Center, homeless response team, adult housing program, holiday assistance, Framing Hope Warehouse, and of course, weatherization where I work.
So what exactly is the Help of Southern Nevada Weatherization Program?
Weatherization program is a program geared toward low-income families, people with children, seniors, and disabilities. And what we do is our goal is to have energy conservation so that way they can save money on their power bill. We can go in there and repair broken windows, solar screens, HVAC repair replacement, water heater, weather stripping, LED lights, low-flow shower heads, insulation, doors, and locks.
Okay, and how exactly do you help the clients fulfill their goals?
Through weatherization, it is an income-based program. And so what we do, the energy auditors go into the home and they help weatherize the home. And these are people that cannot afford to do weather stripping for energy conservation measures to lower the energy bills. Weather stripping, low-flow shower heads, LED lights, solar screens, HVAC repair replacement.
How do LED lights and shower heads help with weatherization of a home?
That's for energy conservation.
Okay. So it's like an overall overhaul to save energy in the home?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it might be obvious, but why is proper weatherization so important in Southern Nevada?
Well, obviously, because it keeps the heat, you know, the heat out and the cool air in.
Yeah. Okay. So when we're talking about things like weather stripping and solar screens, is there a certain type of renovation that you would do first, or is it all encompassing? So for example, when someone is accepted into the weatherization program and they meet all the criteria to have their home weatherized, do you do all of those things, or is it kind of pick and choose?
It is all encompassing as long as the house is suitable. Broken windows, HVAC repair replacements, all those things.
Nice. So besides being income-based, how else do people qualify for the program? Is that the only criteria?
Yeah, that's the only criteria. Social security cards, IDs, yeah, any income, whether that's an award letter, pay stubs, things like that.
Okay. And what other programs does Help of Southern Nevada offer to residents of Las Vegas Valley?
We have the Family Housing Services, which is emergency resource service program, includes Southwest gas assistance, food vouchers, clothing vouchers, hygiene products, baby infant needs, referrals. We have a workforce program, work opportunity readiness, provides pre-employment services for empowering participants to enter and re-enter the workforce. We have Shannon West Homeless Youth Center, the Homeless Response Team, Crisis Team serve chronically homeless and homeless individuals, families living in places not meant for human habitation, adult housing programs, holiday assistance, which we just finished doing that, Framing Hope Warehouse. And Framing Hope Warehouse receives donations, retail merchandise, and building supplies from Good 360 partners in Southern Nevada, including Walmart and Amazon. And then they help redistribute these products to Southern Nevada nonprofits.
Nice. Okay. So the weatherization program specifically, is that for homeowners or also for renters?
No, it can be for renters as well.
Okay. So that would probably be one of the services that clients would reach out to you for after they may have taken advantage of other services, right? Because the way I'm thinking of it is if you're helping people who are experiencing homelessness, or if they happen to have trouble acquiring housing, that's going to come first. And then once they're established, then they could get the weatherization
right.
done.
Yes. Yeah. It's just one of the other programs that we have here at Help of Southern Nevada.
Okay. How do clients find out about this weatherization program?
Well, I'm new to outreach, and I believe they do have billboards, they have news, radio, flyers. I go to resource fairs and discuss weatherization and our Southwest Gas Utility Assistance Program as well.
So where could people find out more about the weatherization program or any of the other programs that Help of Southern Nevada has, whether they're a potential client or whether they're a listener who might want to help out in some way, you know, whether that is donating or volunteering or somehow getting involved with the organization?
They can always go on our website, helpsonv.org. They can always come down here to the 1640 East Flamingo office.
And if they come down to the office, can they just walk in and assess services, or is it better to go online first?
No, they can come in or they can give us a call, 702-795-0575. And also, can I give the main phone number as well?
Yes.
702-369-4357.
Okay. And if people want to volunteer or donate, can they also do that on the website?
Yep, on the website, or they can come down to the building as well.
Okay. And what kind of volunteer opportunities do you have?
We have the holiday assistance volunteers that just passed, but we are always accepting volunteers at Shannon West and at Help of Southern Nevada anytime they can come down.
Okay, perfect. So once again, the website is helpsonv.org, helpsonv.org. The address is 1640 East Flamingo at Maryland, or you can give them a call at 702-795-0575, 702-795-0575. And the main phone number is 702-369-4357. That's 702-369-4357. Whether you are looking for services, whether you know a family who's in need and is looking for services, or if you want to help out in some way, whether you want to donate, whether you want to volunteer, all of that is there on the website, helpsonv.org, for helpofsouthernnevada.org, helpsonv.org. And Maria, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting people know more about what the organization is doing, and especially the weatherization program, because like you mentioned, it's very important in this climate. And I don't think a lot of people know about it. So thank you for being here and letting the listeners know more.
Thank you so much.
I was in the hospital with my son for 18 months.
When he got injured, I wasn't prepared, but I knew I had to be strong.
When I was told about John's injury, I was in complete shock. I just remember rushing into his room and giving him a big hug and letting him know I was there.
These veterans and families are just a few of the heroes we serve at Homes for Our Troops. For thousands of severely injured veterans, everyday life is filled with barriers.
It was really the little things throughout the house. Counters that you can't roll up to.
I had to drag my wheelchair down steps.
I want to help, but he is so determined.
At Homes for Our Troops, we build specially adapted custom homes with features like wheelchair access, roll-in showers, and automatic door openers that allow them to function independently and focus on their recovery and family.
This house is freedom.
It's hope. It's a new beginning.
This house has given me my family back.
To learn more, visit hfotusa.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Alex Chuinsky, a partner at law firm Hunton Andrews Kurth and an expert in energy infrastructure. Prior to joining the firm, Alex was in-house counsel at a major international energy company where his work encompassed all aspects of the oil and gas value chain. Alex, thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So what exactly is the outlook for the oil and gas industry as opposed to renewable energy for 2023?
Well, that is an excellent question, because we are in the middle of, the energy industry is in the middle of a massive transition in terms of source of power generation and energy generation worldwide. It's driven by various factors. Obviously, economics plays an enormous role, but also government policy, the impact of, you know, Paris Agreement, climate targets, net zero carbon emissions targets, regulatory policy to incentivize alternative energy. So all of that's come to the fore, and we're seeing a massive increase in the overall share of renewable energy that's generating power and providing power capacity worldwide. The growth right now worldwide, the overall penetration of wind and solar, for example, worldwide is only 10% of the world's power generation. But in the U.S., it's grown significantly over the last 10 years from, you know, under 10% to now about 25% of our power generation. And countries like emerging markets like China, they're developed market, but the growth engines of the world like China and India are investing significant amounts in renewable energy capacity. Their penetration is significant, but not as significant as their potential capacity. The idea is that China and India are countries that have significant carbon emissions and are wishing to bend that carbon emissions curve. And the hope is that over time, they'll be able to do so with the increased penetration of renewables. That doesn't mean that oil and gas is not going to serve an important role in the continuation of baseline energy throughout the next 20 years. You know, some folks who believe firmly in a net zero transition, carbon emissions net zero transition to 2050, believe that you need to have at least 70 to 80% of the global power generation or energy generation based off of wind and solar only. But with the emergence of new technologies like carbon capture and sequestration, natural gas energy sources are going to become much more capable of providing low to zero carbon emissions over time and still remain an important source of our energy mix for years to come. And of course, you know, oil, even with the transition to EV transportation over time, that's going to require significant increases to our grid capacity, and that's going to take a long time. So we're probably not going to see gasoline shift away from our mix of transportation energy sources for a very long time, despite the proliferation, the incentives for EV vehicles. I think you'll also see greater demand for oil in other areas, like, for example, chemicals and other types of industries associated with that. So the demand for a chemical, for oil and petrochemical products is not going away anytime soon.
Okay. Now, when you talk about EVs affecting the energy grid, I mean, that would make sense if everyone was just kind of plugging into the system. But as it turns out, I think a lot of people who get electric vehicles also get solar panels. So are they still draining from the energy grid? Does the energy grid still need to be bigger to take that into account? Or does it kind of cancel each other out?
Well, we're not at the point yet where it really can cancel each other out. We're nowhere near. And so the grid adequacy is still going to be an issue. So when you combine the just general economic growth and the need for greater power demand globally, add to that the proliferation of EVs, add to that diminishing share of oil and gas being part of the energy mix, that puts a tremendous strain on the amount of renewable power capacity that you need to have on the system, particularly for an intermittent source. It means that you have to pair it with some form of energy storage technology, but be it utility scale lithium ion batteries that are like the mega versions of what you put in your appliances, for example, or some other type of technology like hydrogen that can be used as a store of energy when the wind blows and the sun shines, but you haven't reached peak demand and there's excess capacity. So the short answer is no, and it's going to take a long time to get there. But the other constraint that you have on the grid is the fact that in order to get renewables to power most of your needs, in addition to energy storage, you need to have ultra high voltage, long distance transmission lines. We don't have enough of those. Our grid isn't really suited to add significant amounts of renewable power capacity rapidly. So A lot of investment has to go into that before you can see that happen.
Okay, so that's going to slow down the greater renewable energy penetration that you were talking about, the more solar, more wind turbines. We have to get there gradually?
Yes, and it has already. We're seeing a significant bottleneck when it comes to renewable energy connecting to the grid. There's a whole set of requirements in terms of interconnection studies, the energy markets. There's a very complex energy marketplace on a wholesale basis that people don't see day to day. Your standard energy user doesn't really see behind the scenes. But that market is essential to distributing power to people on a retail basis. And that system has to adapt to energy storage. Part of it is making sure that you can integrate energy storage into the system effectively. Part of it is making sure your grid and transmission systems are adequate to take on that. And that's a huge bottleneck. A lot of these projects are taking years to get the approvals to interconnect, which is basically, you need to have those if you're even going to have a viable, financeable project to begin with, right? So you can't even start developing until you have some line of sight as to your ability to interconnect.
Okay. So besides greater renewable energy penetration, which as it sounds is going to take longer than some of us might like, what exactly are governments and companies doing to achieve net zero carbon emissions in the meantime?
Well, and I wouldn't, you know, even just to make a point related to what you just stated, you can see it as half empty or half full, right? If your goal is to have net zero ASAP, then you might see it as half empty. But if your goal is to, over time, increase the penetration of cleaner energy sources, you're seeing a significant secular trend in that direction. So that's clearly happening. It's just a matter of how quickly can you get there without massive economic dislocation, right? So it's important to keep that in mind. And in terms of what has been done to spur that, a significant amount of what you've seen in terms of growth in wind and solar in the last 10 years has been driven by tax policy. Over the years, there's been legislation to provide significant tax credits for wind and solar developers. Those tax credits have been renewed over time, and they've been expanded most recently in the Inflation Reduction Act. So that has become a huge driver for the proliferation of these technologies. When you look at, you know, how much wind and solar have grown in the U.S. over the last decade or more as a result of tax policy in large measure. And in addition to tax policy, actually, you also have state regulatory requirements that require a specific percentage of power to be generated by renewables. So you have that combination of drivers. Wind has increased, you know, over 300% of capacity, and solar has just been exponential. And that has also coincided with the steep reduction in the cost of providing wind and solar power. It used to be a lot less efficient 10 years ago. We worked out those technology kinks significantly. So the combination of government policy and economics, basic economics in terms of reduction technology risk, the cost reduction from, you know, very resilient supply chain sources have made this much more viable and put us in a position to rapid growth and capacity in terms of renewable sources like wind and solar. The problem, of course, is how quickly can you interconnect them? And can you really put enough into the system to keep up with global energy demand, which grows constantly, particularly in emerging markets?
Right. Okay. Now, sometimes it seems when corporations are trying to achieve net zero carbon emissions, it becomes kind of a matter of creative accounting. So, like, if we invest in renewable energy over here, it cancels out what we're doing with non-renewable energy over there. Is that accurate, or is it much deeper than that?
Well, it gets a little bit complicated, but the idea is to get, what is your overall net zero footprint? And you have to look at, there are three different scopes of emissions activity that companies need to look at to make that assessment. And so there is, you know, a great deal of debate currently as to, you know, what really constitutes net zero. And I think that there's, you know, that debate's going to continue working itself out. We may see some of that develop in the upcoming regulations from the SEC in terms of financial disclosures associated with climate change risks. So I think you're going to see greater evolution as to how that net zero assessment is treated and measured. We're sort of in a situation right now where everyone's talking about it. We've created sort of certain guidelines, but there's no one guideline that governs everything. It's just something that organizations and NGOs and markets have sort of developed. And so there's been some rubrics that have developed naturally over the years But I think you're going to see more and more specificity and clarity as to what might be conventionally considered net zero and from an accounting standpoint. And federal rules may play a big role in that in the coming, you know, year or two.
Okay. Now, one of the other hurdles to having more renewable energy worldwide is obviously the oil and gas industry is extremely powerful and extremely profitable, and it's always been that way. And it kind of seems like there might be powers that be who don't want more renewable energy. I mean, at the risk of, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything, but, you know, just it seems like there's people who wouldn't want renewable energy to overtake fossil fuels. How big can we expect the renewable energy infrastructure to become in the future? Will it always be restricted, or do you think it's going to grow to the point where oil and gas becomes less important?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's restricted. In fact, I would say that policymakers have pushed very hard to develop that industry, as we've seen from the exponential growth that it's had in the last 15 years. So I don't think there's anything stopping it other than sort of natural constraints. You know, how do you deal with the intermittent nature of energy, of renewable energy versus baseline demand needs, right? Or peak needs. Is energy storage going to be sufficiently profitable to make it viable on a commercial basis? Will it meet the test in terms of, you know, minimal technology risk? And can it grow to such an extent that it can provide baseline power as opposed to peak power? So there's some of these limits or constraints are technical and technological. I don't see them as necessarily political. In fact, there's been a lot of pressure on oil and gas companies in the last few years amongst their shareholders, amongst their investors and pension fund and, shareholders to start looking at a more diverse energy mix and to look at lower carbon solutions for their current oil and gas portfolio. And so I think you're seeing that transition even amongst oil and gas companies. It might be slower than what, you know, people outside the industry would like, but you also have to take into account the fact that, you know, we have tremendous infrastructure in the grid and in our transportation system that is based on internal combustion, that's based on fossil fuels, that will take time to change. It's just kind of structural, right? And so until the economics improve, and they have been improving radically, and as you continue to see regulatory incentive, government incentives for cleaner energy, including carbon capture for natural gas power generation and things like of that nature, I think you're going to see even the oil and gas companies transition into a sort of more diverse offering of energy sources. I think you're really seeing that now in real time. I don't think that the industry is a hold up to that. I think what we need to, the way to look at it is that the energy mix really ought to be a diversified mix. And then the question becomes, how can we make that net zero, or how can we restrict carbon to the greatest extent that we can without creating massive economic dislocation? And I think it's doable, and you're seeing it happen in real time. It's just an evolution, and it just takes time to sort itself out and work itself out as technology improves.
Yeah. Okay. So diversifying our portfolio, kind of like investing, is kind of the answer here with the energy mix as well.
Exactly. I mean,
not all the eggs in one basket, right?
Absolutely. And you know, particularly when you're looking at emerging markets of like countries like India and China, where way more than half of their energy generation is coal-based. You know, natural gas is a better alternative than coal when it comes to carbon emissions. It's not perfect. But you're seeing China and India invest in significant investments in renewable with the anticipation of eventually coming off of coal. The problem is you can't come. It's like, you know, it's like smoking. You can't come off of it cold turkey really well,
yeah,
and still support your growing population and support economic growth and lift people out of poverty. You need to find a substitute. And as the penetration of renewables increase in those countries, you're also going to see an increase in natural gas as an alternative, particularly in India, where I think natural gas demand will probably double in the next 10 years or so.
Okay. So what about the price trend of oil and gas over the next year or so? Is it going to come down as demand lessens, or are we not quite there yet?
Well, I think there is concern amongst people in the industry that there isn't going to be sufficient resilience in hydrocarbon prices over time, oil and gas prices, to really sustain additional investment in those industries. And I think there are a couple of things to consider there. One is the impact of exogenous world events like the war in Ukraine, right? Mm-hmm. Those things have a massive effect on the baseline of your price trend. And then trying to predict when that's going to end or when, you know, something else is going to happen that might affect it, it's a difficult thing to do. This is why oil and gas markets are so volatile. And so I think that's a huge factor. But the other factor is that the market itself is trying to figure out what is oil and gas demand going to be like in light of the emergence of all these other technologies, of all these other energy sources. You know, what is the role that oil and gas will play? And I think you're going to see sort of a balance. I don't know that you're going to see, you know, massively high prices in the long term. I don't think that necessarily be super low either. You may see a kind of a moderate trend somewhere where there's just enough to sort of sustain baseline demand and sort of replenish, you know, fields that are being depleted over time. I think part of the concern in the industry now, why you're not seeing massive capital investment in new oil and gas exploration and development, is the fact that there's a lot of pressure on oil and gas companies to maintain strict capital controls amongst their investors. You know, the investors, shareholders want returns, they want their dividends. And so rather than invest hundreds of millions of dollars in exploration campaigns offshore that may not end up yielding anything, I think investors are thinking, let's work with what you have and let's, you know, make a decent return off of that and let's see how the market plays out. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now as to what the future is, and there's resistance to investing more in that sector. Now, if that continues to be the case over time and renewables don't grow sufficiently to catch up with that demand or is unable to because of insufficient energy storage, then you may very well see fossil fuel prices bump up because of scarcity. There's underinvestment, it continues, and there's just not enough for the overall demand picture.
Okay. Now, we've been talking a lot about the big picture, things going on a worldwide scale, the governments, the big corporations, but what should listeners do if they want to have a future with more renewable energy sources? What are the steps they should be taking now? Is it time to look into electric vehicles, time to look into solar? You know, what do you recommend?
Well, I don't know that anyone has to do, you know, I think what people need to do, first of all, is to become aware of what's going on in the industry, right? Understand where your power comes from, what the growth of the various energy sources has been in recent times, to appreciate the fact that we are headed in a direction of cleaner energy and more renewable sources. It's kind of an inevitable, inexorable trend. And so I don't think that people in terms of purchasing power have to do much because those power sources are being driven at the wholesale level and, you know, through economic incentives and regulatory and governmental incentives. In terms of EVs, I think that's going to be a market price mechanism that's going to take over, right? Is it going to be cost effective for people to pay, you know, extra money for additional power in their home to charge up these vehicles versus having a gasoline car? Is there going to be a price premium that the car manufacturers place on EV because of its popularity? So mm-hmm. I think you're ultimately going to see a price mechanism where people will make decisions not based on, you know, what they would hope would be the case, but based on what their pocketbook will allow them. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't support greener approaches, but the market's already moving in that direction. So I think it's really more a factor of people being informed about what's going on in the marketplace and then, you know, understanding that they can make certain decisions, but at the end of the day, we're all sort of, the world is basically pushing towards a more sustainable energy approach. And so we'll all be able to participate in that as the years progress.
Okay, awesome. So where do you suggest that listeners go to find out more about the topic, to educate themselves about what's going on?
Well, I think there are lots of sources out there. The U.S. Energy Information Administration provides a lot of detail, probably more than most people would like. You kind of have to be pretty nerdy to like NADA to enjoy reading this. But I think general outlets that provide information on energy, there are sources out there. There's like even popular websites like Real Clear Energy, for example. There are lots of different sources online where you can get up to the information, what's going on in the market. That doesn't mean that some of these sources might have a slant. I'm sure they all do to some extent. But I think by being a critical reader and reading from the diverse number of sources online, you can develop a great deal of knowledge and understanding of what's going on in the energy market.
Okay, awesome. So U.S. Energy Administration, if you want to geek out, that website is EIA.gov, EIA.gov, and just basically checking out various news sources, see what's going on. But Alex, you've provided a lot of great information about the outlook for not only for 2023, but for the years coming, what we can expect with energy in general, with renewable energies, with fossil fuels, how the world is changing, and how we can all come along for the ride. So I want to thank you for your time and your expertise in being here and talking about this very important topic. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. What I should have said was, if you really want to learn more, listen to more shows like yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
Just a little heads up before something bad happens.
Move your coffee cup away from your computer.
Oh, no, 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 no.
So you can have more control.
Stop. You're texting your boss by mistake.
Uh-oh. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Warning, the cap is loose on that ketchup.
Ugh. Don't wait. You have the power to change the outcome. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me today is Sarah Chavarria, president of the Delta Dental Insurance Company. Delta Dental provides dental benefits to more than 40 million people, and they recently conducted a senior oral health report on older Americans' oral health regrets, barriers, and impact. Sarah, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So what did your research find out about how older Americans view their oral health?
So let's start with our mouths as a gateway to our bodies, and the diseases that start in our teeth and our gums, they can have profound and significant impacts on our overall health, our social well-being, and our quality of life. So we surveyed Americans 50 and over across the U.S., and what we found is that 72% wish they had taken better care of their teeth in youth, yet many still aren't doing so. In fact, 80% are not going to the dentist as often as recommended, which is twice a year for a checkup, cleaning, and this lack of attention to that oral health, it comes with those regrets later in life. So that oral health and that overall health, very, very tightly linked. And as we get older, we're more prone to things like dry mouth, tooth decay, and gum disease.
Why is oral health so closely related to overall health, and why does it impact it so drastically?
So if you think about going to your primary care physician once a year and people going to their dentist twice a year, there can be early indications. So gum disease can be an indication of heart disease or of other things going on in your overall health. And your overall, kind of checkup at the dentist that dentist is going to be able to maybe even see some precancerous indications and things like that. So we should think about it as a preventative checkup to get early, early indications of what could potentially be wrong in our overall health.
Okay, so I've got kind of a chicken and egg scenario question, but I'm not clear whether the oral health issues are the cause of deeper overall health issues, or if they're just the symptom kind of giving us an indicator of what might be wrong on a deeper level.
Yeah, they are definitely an indication, right? So if you go in for that cleaning, you're always going to get that checkup from that dentist, and he or she is going to be able to see an indication, right? Something that is displaying in your gums, something that's displaying in the state of your oral health, that is going to be this looking glass, if you will, into your overall health. So definitely think about it as an indication, and it's showing in your oral health.
Okay, so not brushing our teeth often enough or not going to the dentist often enough is not going to cause further health issues necessarily, but it will remove our ability to see those indicators.
Absolutely. And oral health doesn't only impact our overall health. It also, it's how we view connecting with others and, you know, really what could get in the way of that. Our findings showed that poor oral health, it has an impact on emotional and mental health for older Americans as well. People worrying about how others perceive them based on our smile, smiling less because of worsening oral health as we age. And seniors shared that the way they feel about their teeth, it affects their quality of life. As a matter of fact, in our study, we learned that 2 in 5 seniors say that they smile less than when they were younger due to that declining oral health and the appearance of their teeth. And 30% feel that they're missing out on connecting with people because they're embarrassed to smile or they're embarrassed to laugh.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned something interesting. Why is it that people say they want to prioritize their oral health, and they even say they have regrets about not prioritizing their oral health, and yet they continue not to prioritize their oral health?
That's a really great question. And our report identified that there are really 3 main barriers to what you're asking. And one of them is just a real basic lack of understanding of that connection between oral health and your overall health, which you and I've spent a couple of minutes talking about. And, you know, there was a fun fact identified in the survey, which is that 80% of us 50 and older didn't know that the bacteria that causes gingivitis is spreadable through kissing and through saliva. So fun fact there. The second barrier is access to care. So if we think about the time it takes, people's mobility, and just the, you know, the availability to get to that care, that can be a real barrier. And if we think about our Black and African cultures, and we think about our Latino and our Hispanic communities, the gap for some of these things even widens. And then the final barrier is really those negative emotions that people associate with going to the dentist. Maybe the last time they went, or the story a friend told about the last time they went, has them a little fearful about going to the dentist. And so it's really about overcoming those 3 main barriers and really understanding that getting to that dentist twice a year is part of our overall well-being by making sure we're getting those checkups.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that certain communities are affected even more when it comes to access to care. Which communities do face the biggest barriers to oral health?
In our report, what we saw was that the African and Black Americans and Latino and Hispanic communities, that's where we see those gaps really widen. And I know that in healthcare overall, we're all paying a lot of attention to find ways to close those gaps and to really create avenues for that access to care.
Is it mainly a financial thing, not being able to afford the care, or is it that dentists and other healthcare providers are not in those communities as much?
I think it's really tied back to the 3 barriers we just talked about. I mean, I think if we look at those communities, there may be providers in those communities, and we certainly have a lot of avenues to access to care, not only through dental insurance providers like ourselves, Delta Dental, but also through community partners that bring that access to care to a lot of these communities. So I think it's back to just helping those communities understand that connection between oral health and overall health, and maybe finding ways to help them get that access to care, right? Either transportation, bringing information to where those places are, where they can get that access, whether it's through a community partner or a provider themselves. And then maybe just bringing some better connections into the community to talk about the positive experiences people have going to the dentist as a preventative way to really, you know, make sure that they're not suffering something more painful later or something more serious later.
Okay. So besides visiting the dentist twice a year, as you've mentioned a couple of times, what other tips do you have for people to improve their oral health?
So we subscribe to the 2-1-2. So brush twice daily, very important. Floss once a day. I know folks don't like to do that, but it's really important. I've talked a lot about going to the dentist twice. So that's the 2-1-2. And then there are a lot of things that we can do just at home. Drink a lot of water. If you can drink water with fluoride, that's great. Eat healthy foods like fruits and vegetables. Get some exercise. That's great for your overall well-being, a little bit of mobility in there. And if you've got a partial or a denture, make sure you're taking those out and cleaning them and giving your mouth a break.
Okay. So where can listeners go to find out more about improving their oral health or find out more about Delta Dental?
Please go to dddins.co/healthyaging. That site has a variety of health and wellness resources, insights on your healthy aging journey, and affordable options for individual dental plans. We want to make sure that everyone is smiling.
Okay. So once again, ddins.co/healthyaging. ddins.co/healthyaging. That'll give you more information about improving your oral health for seniors, for aging, but everyone in general can benefit, of course, from implementing healthy oral hygiene now instead of later, because you want to prevent issues the sooner the better with something like dental health. So ddins.co/healthyaging. But again, it's never too late to take better care of our oral health and in turn, take better care of our overall health. So, Sarah, I want to thank you so much for being here today, letting everyone know, first of all, what your survey found out, the things that people regret, the things that we can make changes about, and why it's so important. So I appreciate you being here and sharing with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad, your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Today, I'm speaking with Tara Mancini, Director of Public Policy for Power to Decide. Power to Decide is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to advance sexual and reproductive well-being for all. And they recently conducted a survey about birth control access for Thanks Birth Control Day. Tara, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Heather, for having me.
So what exactly does Power to Decide do?
We, as you said, are a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to advance sexual and reproductive well-being for all. And we accomplish this by providing trusted information, expanding access to quality services, and catalyzing culture change. And one way that we do catalyze culture change is through our Thanks Birth Control Day campaign that you mentioned.
What prompted that recent survey and the campaign on birth control?
Sure. So we usually do polling or survey every year about different attitudes around birth control, but particularly this year, we wanted to know how people felt in light of the Supreme Court decision in June, which Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, which overturned Roe v. Wade. In that decision, there was an opinion from Justice Thomas in which he said that other already established rights from other Supreme Court cases should be revisited. And one, Griswold v. Connecticut, the one that gave married couples the right to use contraception, he said should be revisited. And so since that time in June, we have seen people, you know, turned away at some pharmacies from purchasing birth control. There's been a number of concerning stories across the country. And so we really wanted to gauge how that has been impacting communities around the country.
Okay. So first of all, why are pharmacies turning people away from accessing birth control? Is this like just exercising what they perceive to be their own personal rights to make that decision? Or is there some kind of ruling coming down in different pockets across the country that's actually outlawing birth control as well?
No, there aren't any rulings that are coming down. Many pharmacies do have policies in which if it conflicts with your personal beliefs, then there are usually policies in place where you can be excused from that, but you have to make sure that the person is provided with birth control in terms of either making sure there's another pharmacist on staff who can provide you with that. But, you know, we did see, I'm forgetting the state right now, but someone, a cashier, even not even the pharmacist, who refused to sell condoms to a couple during the summer. So there are existing policies that allow people to exercise their rights and beliefs, but also I think people are emboldened by that decision.
Yeah. Okay. So what are some of the key findings from the survey that tell us what people are thinking about this whole situation?
Sure. So we found that nearly 6 in 10 young adults, so that's age 18 to 29, say that the decision from the Supreme Court that I mentioned, overturning Roe, leads them to believe that birth control will be harder to access. And this is pretty stark to the percentage of folks who think that it's birth control is currently difficult for people to access in the U.S., which is 27%. So nearly a doubling in terms of what people think that is currently difficult to access versus in the future based on the Supreme Court decision. And then we also found that, you know, higher percentages of those who face greater systemic barriers, such as Black and Hispanic people and people with annual household incomes under $50,000, higher percentages of those groups think that it'll be harder to access birth control in the future.
Okay. So you've given a couple of examples of pharmacies that are already making it harder to access birth control, but I'm not sure if that's like kind of a one-off situation or if that's foreboding future. So what do you think? This belief that birth control is going to get harder to access, is that belief founded or not?
It is founded, but it's not just, that is just one example, pharmacies. You know, we have seen, you know, even before this decision, for example, in Missouri in 2021, there was a bill to try and carve out IUDs and emergency contraception from being covered by Medicaid. So meaning that if it had passed and it didn't, that folks who have Medicaid would not be able to use their insurance to cover those methods, if those are the methods that they need or want. And we have seen also, you know, in Idaho, where there is a law in which some universities have interpreted very recently this fall as saying that employees of the university should not refer their students to birth control services. So those are just two examples, you know, off the top of my head. And there are states like Texas where, you know, the women's health program does not cover emergency contraception. So I think there are instances around the country, these smaller examples that maybe are not well known, but when you add them all up, plus the Supreme Court decision, I think it is concerning. Definitely. And I, you know, we are waiting right now, obviously, we're at the end of the year, state legislatures will be coming into session, most of them beginning in January. And so I think folks should be vigilant around the country, including in Nevada, about what sort of bills are being brought up.
So what can people do when you say be vigilant? What can listeners actually do to make a difference and to make sure that there's a solution in place rather than just watching this happen?
That's a great question. Well, I would say that they should continue to tune into you and learn about what's going on in their community. And then there are a number of things also at the federal level. Right now, we are waiting for the federal government to fund the government for the rest of the fiscal year 2023, which goes until September 30th of next year. A lot of programs that need to be funded, including the Title X Family Planning Program, which most folks haven't probably heard, but funds clinics and communities all across the country, including in Nevada, Southern Nevada. So this program has been underfunded for a number of years. It's a fantastic program. It's been around for 50 years, but for the last nearly 10 years, there's not been an increase in funding, and it's not been able to keep pace with the need. So I would encourage all listeners to reach out to their members of Congress to let them know that this is urgent and that this program needs to be funded. Your listeners can visit powertodecide.org to find out more about this. And we also have an easy way for folks to contact their members of Congress. And another thing I just want listeners to be aware of in Nevada is of your, you know, current policies. Nevada does have a lot of great state level policies that has passed over the last few years regarding birth control. Most insurance plans cover up to a 12-month supply of pills, patches. And so this is a really great policy if people know about it.
Yeah.
So consumers knowing about it is the first step. Also, their providers, and if their provider says it's okay and writes the prescription that way, then most insurance companies should cover that so that you don't have to keep returning to the pharmacy every month. We all know that can be, you know, just a really big hassle that's not needed. And then Nevada also has passed a law in 2021 to allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control. So that is also we have seen in some states has been like Oregon has been very helpful. They're still implementing that. There's not an end date, one that's going to be available, but I would say to be on the lookout for that. And once that is in place, pharmacists who want to can undergo training to prescribe birth control to consumers.
Okay, that sounds great. All right. So once again, if you want more information, powertodecide.org is the website to go to, powertodecide.org. You can find out more about what Power to Decide does. You can find out more about the current state of birth control across the nation and how you can access it, how you can contact various political representatives and let them know what you think and what needs to be supported. So it's all laid out on powertodecide.org. And Tara, I want to thank you so much for being here today and letting us know exactly what's going on, what the outlook is, what people believe, and what we can do about it. So I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Heather. I appreciate your time as well.
I'm Tumani. When I was younger, I may have did some stupid things. I committed some crimes, and even got shot, but I'm not a criminal.
That's right. I'm Jamal. I work for Youth Advocate Programs. Yeah, I was Tumani's advocate, helping him stay out of jail, stay in the neighborhood, get a job, and work hard to see a better future for himself. If you have a change of mindset, you can have a change of action.
As a little kid, I experienced trauma and I acted out. Made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
No, she's a good student and a great kid. As Jalen's YAP advocate, I'm always here for her. With the Youth Advocate Programs, I was able to connect with Jalen.
YAP is a community-based alternative to youth incarceration, congregate placement, and neighborhood violence. After completing our program, 86% of participants were arrest-free. YAP works.
And now, I'm a YAP advocate, helping kids like me find a better way.
Youth Advocate Programs. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn how at yapinc.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, January 23rd at 8 p.m., benefiting Project Inclusion, and Monday, February 6th at 8 p.m., benefiting Adopt a Vet. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their second annual Trailblaze Challenge presented by Subaru of Las Vegas, February 3rd to 5th, with a 12-week training that's going on now. This is a 26.2-mile hike through the Valley of Fire backcountry in Mesquite, with the goal of raising $300,000 to grant wishes for children with critical illnesses in Southern Nevada. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/trailblaze. That's wish.org/snv/trailblaze.